Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as well as being a proud member of the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to veteran screenwriter Neil Marshall Stevens. Over the course of the interview, I talked to him all about his storied 30-plus year career in screenwriting, including his involvement on the 13th Ghost remake, his long-standing relationship with Full Moon Pictures, and the experience of having one of his original scripts turned into a Hellraiser sequel. Plus, we talk about the law of diminishing returns when it comes to jump scares, why he wrote his Full Moon Pictures stuff under a pseudonym, and what he is currently working on now. All of which you can hear right now in my interview with Neil. Hello, Neil. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Oh, thank you very much.
Good to have you on the show. So we're going to talk to you about a variety of things, about your screenwriting career, but a good place to start, I feel, because the 20th anniversary will be coming up later on in the year. And also, we did a Guilty Pleasure podcast episode on the movie. We will start with 13 Ghosts. So how did you first come on board 13 Ghosts?
I had just sold a script called Debtor, which was sort of my big breakthrough sale. My wife, Judith, who would, you know, I'd convinced to manage me, had gone out and kind of cold called a bunch of people. I'd been working, doing direct-to-video stuff for Charlie Band at Full Moon, and I'd been writing tons of very low budget stuff for him, you know, and I'd written just dozens of these very cheap, low-budget stuff. And in between writing those scripts, which I would knock out in like a week or 10 days, I would be writing my own spec scripts. And one of those scripts, I wrote like a big epic taking place during the Great Fire of London and a comedy about jury fixing, and I wrote a bunch of just anything that I things that I wanted to write. And I realized that I didn't have a horror script to write, so I wrote, you know, and nothing that was out as in horror was really scaring me. So I thought I'd write a script that would really scare me. And I wrote this thing called Debtor, which was my idea of what a horror movie would be like. And so she'd gone out earlier and sold this sort of science fiction love story, which had gotten optioned, but then nothing happened with that. And nobody cared about it. Unfortunately, it did ultimately sell later. I wrote this horror movie called Debtor. She went out with that, and she sent it to Stan Winston's company. A producer there really liked it and said, "Do you mind if I slip it to a few people?" He slipped it to a few people. That was like on a Wednesday. One of the places they sent it to was to Dimension and a bunch of other places. Got a call from Bob Weinstein on Saturday. You know, my wife Judy didn't say, "I read half this script. I really love it. It's fucking fantastic. Come in on Monday. I want to talk to you about it." So we went on a Monday and they bought it for like $500,000. So that was kind of exciting because we were basically broke. And so this script went all over town. Everyone loved it. I got credit. I was like the flavor of the month. And I got an agent as a result of that. And the agent got me a bunch of work. And one of the jobs they got me was doing the rewrite of 13 Ghosts for Joel Silver, Dark Castle. And some other jobs. And so they got on the phone with development exec from Dark Castle, I believe is Susan Levin. Pretty sure. It's like I said, it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
It was a very nice lady and pitched my take for my take on 13 Ghosts. I mean, I'd seen the original movie, you know, years before. And my take, which they said, yeah, it's fantastic, we love it, you're hired, totally different from what they ultimately used. Different idea for the house, different idea for what the family is like. My idea was that it ended up being sold to, like, almost like the Hatfields and the McCoys. It was like two feuding families who ended up inheriting this house. And so, like, they were at war within this house full of ghosts, and they were trying to kill each other, and the ghosts were trying to kill both sides. And it all kind of was, so it was this really weird kind of battle within this house full of ghosts that was trying to kill both of them. And the idea for the house was that in order to catch a ghost, ghosts haunt certain locations. So if you want to catch the ghost, what you have to do is you actually have to, like, take the place where the ghost is inhabited and move it. So if the ghost is haunting, like, a lighthouse, you actually have to disassemble the whole lighthouse and move it. Or if the house is inhabiting, like, a piece of a store, you have to, like, disassemble the whole thing and move it, so that this house, this huge mansion, consists of chunks of different environments that have been disassembled and plunked down in the middle of this huge mansion. So right. you kind of move from one place to another. You move from, like, a piece of a grocery store to a piece of a cavern to a piece of a lighthouse. You moving, and they are, the ghosts are inhabit these different places within this big huge house, this big mansion. And you know, so that was how I imagined this thing looked. As a lighthouse is sticking out of one place, and there's a piece of a subway tunnel in the basement, and however the heck this thing is laid out. And that was what I pitched. But ultimately, when I got there, I went into Joel Silver and said, nah, I don't like it. This is what I want to do. And so he pitched his own idea. And basically the idea he pitched was what we ended up doing. So that's how I ended up getting involved in 13 Ghosts. Because what I didn't fully understand there is that they weren't really buying my pitch. They were buying this new hot writer who just sold this big hot script. And they didn't care what I was pitched. Could have been anything. I could have said, it's like, you know, I imagine this is, like, taking place on the far side of the moon. And it's, yeah, fine, it's fantastic, we love it, but come on over, we'll hire you. You know, and they were going to tell me what they wanted me to do. And that was really how it worked.
So was Joel Silver's pitch back to you the thing about the glass house? Were they always keen on this idea of the glass house?
Yeah, well, see, Joel Silver is a huge architecture fan. He lives in a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and he had just found out the Museum of Natural History in New York had just rebuilt their planetarium. And the planetarium, which you probably don't know, was a gigantic glass cube.
Right.
And he was fascinated by this. And not only did he want the house to be a big glass cube, he wanted the hero, I'm spacing on the guy's name. He wanted him to work in the planetarium, and he wanted the planetarium, which is also a big glass cube, to feature in the story. And so for, I think, virtually every draft that I wrote, he worked in the planetarium, and there were scenes that took place in the Museum of Natural History as well. And so all of this took place in New York, and then the house was out on Long Island. He worked in the planetarium. So they used the planetarium was one of the settings of the 13 Ghosts version that I wrote.
Because he originally worked in, like, a museum or something. He doesn't seem to work anywhere in the movie.
He's a school teacher, which he was in the original movie.
Yeah.
He was a school teacher. And it always bothered me a little bit how a school teacher could afford a nanny. That was a little bit odd. And the idea that he was broke, but they could afford a nanny.
That is something we talked about in the episode, yeah, when we're doing the plot breakdown. It seemed, it seemed sort of absurd that he could
afford
a nanny despite being...
You know, That was a question that I raised when they brought it up, and I think they just said, "Eh, I don't care." okay. Well, I mean, here's the point. Back when this movie was made, which was in the early '60s, mm-hmm, and there were a lot of movies like this. you had this kind of very odd situation where families were, where you had the stay-at-home mom and the kids and the father who was struggling and almost broke, but somehow or other, they always managed to have a full-time housekeeper. Yeah, and no one, you know, I don't know, maybe she just lived under the sink and ate table scraps. I don't know how they managed to afford this full-time woman who's like tending to everybody, even though the wife is literally not doing a goddamn thing. But
it does seem slightly absurd. Although in the original, they seem to kind of inherit the maid. Like, she seems to be like not doing it for the money. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
well, I mean, I guess, did you ever see the movie The Help? I guess it's kind of like that. She's black woman is just, she's just there. She doesn't, she just works for the love of it, but not actually for money. So
it's weird. Like in the original, it kind of like, yeah, they seem to inherit the maids with the house.
Yeah. Like, so yeah. Well, whatever. It was interesting situation with the script, which is that I came in, I wrote a whole bunch of drafts, again, all taking place in New York and with the Museum of Natural History. And they were, you know, was quite happy with it. And it was like, and they wanted to go back up a little bit. When they first brought me in, one of the things that had, these were all based on William Castle movies. And they'd done House on Haunted Hill, which is also based on a William Castle movie. And one of the things that Joel liked about this was the idea of the glasses. And you put the glasses on, you see the ghost, you take the glasses off, you don't see the ghost. And in the original thing, in the original movie, it wasn't glasses. It was this kind of little weird paddle with like a blue plastic slot and a red plastic slot. And what they did is they projected the ghosts on the screen. Let's say that they projected the ghosts and they were in red through a red filter projected on the screen. So if you looked through the blue filter, you could see the ghost. If you looked through the red filter, because the ghosts were projected in red, you couldn't see the ghost. And the idea is, hey, look, when they put on the glasses, you look through the blue filter. But if it's too scary, look through the red filter and the ghost will disappear. That was the idea.
Yeah.
But the idea, the premise is, if you put the glasses on, you see the ghosts. You take the glasses off, you can't see the ghosts. And Joel really liked the idea of somehow duplicating that actual effect. That is, giving people glasses in the theater. They put the glasses on, they can see the ghosts. They take the glasses off, the ghosts will disappear. And speaking to the people in development, they say, look, we've been working with ILM, and they say that they're really close to duplicating that effect. They're close to doing that. They say, you know, like, it depends. Maybe if the background is really busy, they can kind of make it work. And I'm thinking, really? Really? Because I don't know about that, because you know what? All a filter can do, a filter can kind of filter things. I don't see how taking the thing away is going to make something disappear, and putting is going to make something. It doesn't seem right. Even polarizing, I don't see. But say no. They're very close to it, and they kind of showed me the test, and you can kind of see how, because it was against a very busy background, but even with the very busy background, I could see the ghost. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, it's like, you know, being close to making that thing disappear is like being close to perpetual motion. I mean, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, I don't know how that they're really going to be able to do this. Doesn't seem likely, but I didn't want to rock the boat. So for like the first three or four passes on this script, I actually had the crawl at the beginning say, yes, well, put the glasses on when they put the glasses on, and when they take the glasses off, take the glasses off. And so there was this whole business where, depending on whether the glasses were on or off, you either saw Cyrus or you didn't. And then it was kind of a trick, because of course Cyrus pretended to be a ghost but turned out not to be a ghost. And so there was a point where you were taking the glasses off. It's like, oh my God, we actually see Cyrus. He's not really a ghost. But in the end, it was obvious that whole idea just went away, because they There was no way
it just wasn't going to happen.
It wasn't, was not going to happen. That ILM couldn't get to that little bit where it could actually be made to work. So it was just didn't happen.
I mean, that seems a big stretch even for now, never mind 2001.
It would be a stretch for 52,001. It's an impossibility. It's contrary to the laws of physics. Yeah. You can't do that. This is no way.
So were you the first writer? Well, because I mean, obviously there was a few writers involved. The other credited writer is Richard Diavadio, and there's a couple of uncredited writers. Were you the first writer on board the project?
I was the first writer, and so this is what happened. I was the writer. I kind of got up to a certain point, and they say, "Okay, we love the script. Now we're gonna." And then the director comes on board, and we go on. And essentially, they said, "All right, he'll give you your nights." We're one pass away from kind of being from a production draft. And then I got his notes, and he had just tons of notes that were kind of all over the place. And I wish I kind of had his notes. I don't think I kept them, or I had my response to his notes, which were probably quite colorful. But what I really sort of said is, look, these notes are kind of all over the place. I've seen notes like these before, and these notes are such that we're not one pass away from a production draft. These notes are the beginning of a development process, and even trying to deal with them in any way. And if you start down this road, you're going to be a year or 18 months away from being ready to shoot. It's just the way it is, because it's taking this script in like five different directions. Cause it's he's not thinking in terms of stories. He has like a dozen different ideas. It's taking the script in all sorts of different directions. And, you know, he had this idea. It's like, well, I have this image of like the house is reflected in a lake, and there's like this pedestal on the other side of the lake, and someone is activating something at the pedestal, and that's what's making the house seal up. And I said, well, that's kind of a lovely image, but who is it that's standing at the pedestal? And if whoever it is sealing up the house, how does he get from standing at the pedestal to inside the house that's now sealed up? But it's like, he's not even thinking about that. He just has this image in his head and it is a lovely image, but how does it relate to the story? And who is this, whoever it is, and how does that whoever it is get into the house? But it's like, that's just, he just has this image, has this idea, and he has lots of these ideas, just these ideas. And by the way, that never got into the script, because somewhere along the line somebody said to him, it doesn't fit into the, you have this lovely image that doesn't fit into the script, sorry. but the point is, I can't be the guy that tells him that, because I'm just the writer.
Sorts of situations where you're kind of hired by a studio, you know, that you don't really have a lot of power as a writer.
Well, no writer has any power unless the writer is also the producer or the director. It's just the way it is. So, I mean, this is what I said, and what I was told is, well, do the notes that you can, and we'll go from there. And I say, I'll do the notes that I can. So I did the notes that I could, which weren't very much. And then there was this kind of long, chilling sort of silence. And then I called up and said, well, did you take a look at this? Yeah, we took a look at the script. Thanks. Long, chilling silence. And then I kind of knew that I was, because no one likes to call you up and say you're off the project. So they respond by just these kind of long, cold silences. And then at some point I called my agent and said, yeah, you're off the project. You know, but I had other things I was doing at the time. So it's like, it's whatever. And then I think it was like 6 months later, 8 months later, I don't know, like 10 months later, I got a call back from my agent, and they said that that Warner Brothers Dark Castle had called her. They were looking for another writer for 13 Ghosts, because they'd been through like a couple other writers working on this script. And they wanted yet another writer. And she said, well, you know, Neil still has another pass to do. When you let him go, he had another step that he's owed another step. Why not just bring him back? And so they called me up and said, well, all right. And they sent me the script, which was like two writers later. And I could tell by reading it that these two other writers had been heroically attempting to execute the notes of the directors, which were just, and the result was just a disastrous mess. And I called them up and said, look, I said, however many months ago, that there was just nothing you could do with these notes. They're taking the script in a dozen different directions. If what you want is to go back to my last draft and give me a set of notes on that draft, I'll do that. But I can't deal with his notes because they just, it's going to take us nowhere. So I don't want to hear his notes. I don't want to talk to the director. Just give me a set of notes on this thing and we'll go from there. And they said, yeah, okay, fine. And so they gave me a set of notes. I did another pass on the script and then I called him and said, so how do you like it? I said, yeah, we saw it. It's fine. And I said, oh, okay. I guess I'm off the script again, which I was. Mm-hmm. And when they brought in Richard DeVidio, the changes that they made didn't really have much of anything to do with the director's notes. Mostly they had to do with a number of production issues. One, it was obvious that they couldn't shoot this thing on location in New York. So the Museum of Natural History was out. They moved it back to LA or wherever the hell they shot it. So that whole thread of the Museum of Natural History was out. They took it back to him being a teacher, which he was in the original script. And also, they had spoken to me at some point early on about introducing an African-American character. And originally, I had wanted the wisecracking psychic to be that character. And they kind of shot that down, and I'm not really sure why.
You mean the Matthew Lillard character?
Yeah, the Matthew Lillard character. Yeah, right. And the in my version of it, the au pair, the nanny character had been this kind of fumbling British au pair, who turned out to be the one who was in cahoots with
Cyrus.
With Cyrus. And like she was the one who was kind of like manipulating the kids and putting them where they needed to go and had been manipulating the family. He put her there in order to do that. And that at a certain point, you know, she's wandering around and comes across Cyrus and they end up in each other's arms. And so she was the secret bad guy. But of course, in making her into the kind of sassy black woman, you got that great line about where's the lawyer, he split, which is a fantastic line for which I can't take credit. It's one of the great lines of the movie, but not mine. So
it is one of the genuine laughs in the movie.
and it's for which Richard DeVidio deserves all the credits, not mine. However, the lawyer being split, that's mine.
Okay. Yeah. So you get the best bit of the movie, like us.
And I mean, there is another sequence which was mine, but which was not really, which should have been just as good, but was not done to the as well as it should have been done. Which is the kids, and then later, what's her name, caught between the closing sheets of the wall, the closing glass, almost like two giant slides, you know, microscope slides, which as I'd written it, they'd been stuck there and the glass is the walls of glass are coming together very, very slowly as they're kind of stuck. And then they manage to escape and she's stuck and it comes together very, very slowly. I don't think he fully understood the idea of a slow scare.
I don't think he understood the idea of a slow scare at all.
No, and this notion of like of this like sparky electric fast cut thing, because I think that for him what a scare was kind of a jump scare, and so the idea was how can I make every scare into like 10 jump scares in a row? But that's not. I mean, all you have to do is watch any really well constructed horror movie, and you can realize that yes, of course there are jump scares. But there are also slow scares, and you know, you watch The Shining, you watch The Haunting, you watch any of those, you know, even Night of the Living Dead. The slow scares, the slowly building, ratcheting scares, which and which were in the script, but he never quite got this idea of, you know, a scare where something is slowly advancing on you and you can't escape or can't escape quickly. Those are terrifying moments. And I don't think he quite understood it. The movie's tremendously successful. Lots of people really love it. So I got paid a decent amount of money for it, and I'm still getting paid for it. So it's like, oh yeah, they didn't achieve my artistic vision. I'm not going to do that. I mean, Silver's a super successful producer. The movie's was very successful. Tons of people really like it. It has lots of stuff in it that really works. It's, you know, so I'm not gonna stand here and bitch about it. You know, if I had somehow had my druthers, it might have been different. But I don't know that if it had been different, it would have been more successful. Who knows? But you know, that's so it goes. You know.
Fair enough. And like you say, it has its own cult following, and it was a very successful movie. It doesn't surprise me, like what you were talking about all the notes. Having seen 13 Ghosts and having seen Steve Beck's other film, Ghost Ship, doesn't surprise me about all the notes. They're not movies that have. They're movies that are packed with a lot of things where I keep feeling like the director's just like, well, that looks cool. Yeah, we'll go. And this looks cool. That's my impression.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you've worked as a writer a lot, you often hear this thing being said about directors. He's got a great visual sense, and I don't think the producers necessarily understand that when a writer hears that, there's a kind of tightening around the middle. It's like, oh my God, because generally he's got a great visual sense means, oh, he's worked in music videos and commercials a lot, because that's usually what it means. And I would much rather have someone who's done a lot of TV, who's worked a lot of TV, who's worked a lot with, you know, with story, who knows how to tell a story with a camera, then has a great visual sense. Because if you know how to tell us, doing the great visuals is great, but knowing how to tell a story with a camera is always going to trump anything else. Is how to work with actors, how to tell a story with a camera and with people. Is what's going to really matter to an audience, I think, always.
I would agree with that. I think there is some directors who can be visual stylists, but also make movies that have an internal logic.
I think the point is, you think of someone like Kubrick and say, well, Kubrick is fantastic is with visuals. But then you look at something like Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove has some of the most brilliant characterization of any movie. And well, you remember those characters, you remember the dialogue, and it's like, yes, visually it's fantastic, but it's also, you know, it's the characterization is brilliant too. So it's always in the service of these ideas.
Well, yeah, I know. I feel like it's kind of you can marry the two, and I think like Kubrick's a good example of that. Like my personal favorite film is The Shining, and that is full of great visuals, but it's also full of memorable characters that you actually care about.
Yeah, and even Clockwork Orange, it's like you know, and yeah, of course, something like 2001, you know, you'd have to say characters. But even in Clockwork Orange, someone like Hal, who's just a light on a panel, his death is moving.
That is true. That is true. You know. So still drawing an emotion. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and ultimately, if you're not connecting to characters, the spectacle is not going to. Is not going to connect, you know, is going to amount to very much.
Were you, I mean, like the first time you saw 13 Ghosts, were you, I mean, like, I know you said you don't want to kind of shit on the film, and that's understandable. And as we said, it has a cult following. It was very, very successful. But was there a part of you that was disappointed the first time you saw it?
I mean, there were things about it that I really liked. I mean, I liked the opening. There were other things about it that I obviously wish had been developed more. But I mean, on the whole, I mean, I thought the casting was really good. I thought there were some scenes that were really quite effective, and other things I was a bit disappointed about. You know, and again, there were certain moments. You know, the whole talk about the Black Zodiac and all that stuff. I thought, yeah, that was pretty good. Which, you know, for sometimes you come up with an idea, and the whole idea of the Black Zodiac, the stars in the sky, you know, the things in the sky, hell has its own thing, its own stars or whatever. The Black Zodiac. I thought, that's kind of a good idea. And, you know, and just how do you account for the ghosts? And it's like, these are the things in the hell sky. I was like, that sounds pretty good. Sure. And you work out what the symbols are. And that was all kind of, you know, that worked. Mm-hmm. It sometimes part of what kind of works in a lot of horror movies is inventing its own past, inventing an underlying mythology. And yeah, I know the Latin isn't right for whatever the heck it is. I don't give a shit about that. I went to Boston.
Yeah, like stuff like that is like, you know. It's fine. I can always gloss over about that. I always assume that stuff is wrong anyway. So like, you know, as long as I'm involved in the story, like I don't really care.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I took 2 years of Boston Latin school, and I burned all my Latin cards. I don't want to give a shit whether the Latin's correct or not. It's a, you know, there's a reason why it's a dead language. Screw it. So yeah, whatever the hell that thing is called, I don't care. It just, so long as it sounds good, you know. But you know, it's like let someone come back from ancient Rome and correct me. But you know, the underlying mythology had a realistic feel to it. I've had cause to do that in a bunch of different movies, and I kind of like coming up with those, with that mythological underpinning that feels has a kind of realistic feel to it. And I think the Black Zodiac was one of those things that worked. Yeah. I mean, of the various movies that have of mine that have been made, I like 13 Ghosts on the whole. I mean, sure, there are flaws here and there, and things that I wish had been done differently. But you know, I think it worked out well. You know, yeah, and you know, there are many grounds for liking it.
Yeah. So it kind of at the start of the interview, you said before you were hired on 13 Ghosts that you had written this script called Deader that yes. had sold for $500,000. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that as well, because that script in the end ended up becoming a Hellraiser movie.
Yeah.
The seventh Hellraiser movie, which is the kind of pattern of Hellraiser movies. After the fourth Hellraiser, it seems like most Hellraisers were not Hellraiser movies to begin with and then became Hellraiser movies.
Yeah.
So were you aware of this process, part of this process, did it just get bought and then it just... totally made behind you, without your knowledge, or what was your experience of that?
I mean, they made it. We went into development on it for a year and a half. A director was attached. We were going to go ahead and make it. And then at the last minute, I think Bob Weinstein just kind of, for whatever reason, decided not to do it. I don't really know why. It's one of these odd situations where... for whatever reason, whether he didn't feel that it was franchisable or something, I don't really know why. And it's not like they're like guys like Bob Weinstein are all that terribly interested in explaining why they want to say no. They just said no, and he moved on. And it was I don't know whether it was 6 months later or a year later, they kind of came back and they said, hey, they're interested in making this movie over into a Hellraiser movie. Would you like to be involved? And I said, no, not really. I mean, again, the whole budget of the movie was probably not much more than $1 million, and the script cost $500,000. So it's it had to be one of the most expensive scripts for a Hellraiser director video movie in the history of the world. And again, I think they're just trying to save some, salvage it in some way. So they brought someone else on to rewrite it. I think it was Carrie Wuerer was
the star. Yeah.
Was the star. And she was fine. I think a lot of it was not very well done.
So have you seen Hellraiser Deader, and how much of your script survived?
Yes, I have seen it. I mean, it's a lot. A bunch of my script is there in to some degree, although oddly changed. I mean, the subway scene, the scene in the subway is there with the wandering club. That's from my script. The scene in the apartment where she finds the girl hanging in the bathroom is there, but all of it a little bit different, hyped up, and kind of just not quite as good. And I'll tell you something that bothered me about it. I mean, among other things.
Sure.
Go for it. First of all, they've moved it to, I guess, Romania. She's now in Romania. She's working. And she's working in this kind of indie newspaper somewhere or other. I think maybe it starts in London, then she goes off to Romania. It starts in London. Yeah. And it's like, well, we found this mysterious tape, and it's inexplicable. As I wrote it, this was a long time ago. So it was back in the days of videotape. So you find a VCR, VHS tape. And they play it. And the whole point of why it strikes them as inexplicable is because the entire tape is one uninterrupted take. The same way that if you took a home video camera and just pointed it at something and let it run. And what the tape shows is this woman being stripped. They put her down on this bed covered with plastic. Someone takes a gun, aims at her head, pulls the trigger, blasts a hole right through her head. Guy lies down on her, breathes into her mouth, and she comes back to life, sits up, puts her finger in the hole in her head, all in one single uninterrupted shot.
Right.
And this is, you know, the whole, this movie all took place before CGI, before the possibility of any kind of special effects. That's what impresses both of them, the editor, and what impresses Amy Klein. This is obviously home video, single camera, single take, one uninterrupted shot. But that's not what they did. This looked like it. This was like six different cameras. They were like shooting like they hired someone that they used for like covering a bar mitzvah or something, with like six different cameras shooting this from six different angles, and then afterward they cut it together. So it's obvious. It's like, how do you explain? It's like, what is there to explain? They could have done this. They could have cut this together any which way. It's obvious that there's nothing to explain. Because the effect of shooting her, the effect of her coming back of life, could easily have been done the way it actually was done, as a special effect. So everyone's going to just shrug and say, well, this is just some cheesy movie, as indeed it was. So there's nothing to explain, nothing to investigate, nothing for her to track down. It only works, it only makes sense if it's one single uninterrupted shot. And This is something that's bugged me since I was like 6 years old, when I was watching movies that had like, you know, security cameras or things that are obviously supposed to be seen just from one single shot. And you watch it and suddenly it's like cutting to three different angles. It's like, how is it, if it's just like a security camera, it's suddenly cutting to three different angles? Who's doing the cutting? How is it doing that? Bothered me from ever since I was a little kid. And it's like somehow directors think that audience members are too stupid to understand that. And we have never been that stupid, and we know that it's wrong. And it was wrong when I was like 6 years old watching it, and it's still wrong.
Yeah, I get it. And yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. But like, the scene in the movie, the movie as is, doesn't work, because they could have just assumed it was a pretend snuff film, and it's been done by these people doing special effects, and probably, I mean, obviously for the plot to happen, you know, they need to take it seriously. Yeah. But you know, like, yeah,
but that's not a reason to do it. Yeah,
the way it's presented. Yeah, no, like it is one of watching the movie, it does feel like kind of one of the things of like, we're going to believe in the veracity of this because the plot says so. But yeah, I mean, like, it should have just been like they threw the video in the bin and like that moved on to the next assignment.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's the kind of thing that's very frustrating to me. And the other point is, there's a scene in, I don't mind knocking this movie. I'm perfectly happy I'm perfectly happy doing this, because I really don't give it, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Just making the point. 13 Ghosts. 13 Ghosts. I have respect for that movie. Jill Silver is a producer I genuinely respect. The people involved in that movie, I have real respect for. 13, Debtor, not so much. Anyway. Scene when Amy is stabbed, there's a couple of things. As I wrote it, the way in which I conceived this thing is that she's lying on her back asleep, and we see it in almost complete blackness. And as I'm sure you understand, when you're in very dark, you lose color vision. And you see the world in this kind of very grainy black and white. I mean, that's how we see. We lose, because of the, rods and cones, your color vision vanishes when it's really dark. And I had this experience when I was quite young, when I was just a little kid, and I kind of woke up in the middle of the night, and I felt like my nose was running, and I didn't understand what was going. I couldn't stop my nose from running, and so I got out of bed, and I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I just kind of stumbled into the bathroom. My nose was running; I couldn't stop it, and I turned on the light. And suddenly, as the light came on, I realized my whole face was covered with blood because I'd gotten a nosebleed in the middle of the night because it was so dry. But that sudden switch from just having this like blackish stuff on my face, and suddenly it becomes vivid red as the light comes on, is something that I wanted to duplicate in this scene. So she's lying in her room in the dark. And something kind of hits her in the back. And this stuff, because it's dark, just looks just dead black, kind of starts trickling down her back. And she's feeling it, and she doesn't know what the hell it is. And she shows no pain, feels no pain. And so she just gets up and kind of stumbles into the bathroom, still black, completely black. And she's just feeling it. And as she's feeling it, it's just blackness, because it's that dark. And that kind of weird grainy dark that you experience when it's really dark. And they kind of did it because they had that kind of blue light, which they used to simulate darkness. That's kind of phony, but you kind of buy into it. And then she turns on the light and suddenly she's covered in blood. Okay. And then it's like, where the hell is this blood coming from? And she looks down at the front of her chest and there's just this tiny little bit of metal, almost just like a splinter coming out of from between her breasts. And it's like, what the hell is that? And she starts trying to reach around to her back. And then she looks behind her back. And then she sees that there's a knife stuck between her shoulder blades. That's the sequence of events.
Yeah.
And so when we first see that tiny little bit of metal, that gleaming bit of metal, we don't know what it is. She doesn't know what it is. And it's only when she looks behind her that we all understand what the hell has happened, that she's been stabbed in the back. And she doesn't feel the pain, which is also part of this terrifying experience. But the way they shot it, she's got this big fucking blade coming straight out from between her breast. So obviously, the whole thing is, first of all, we know that it's blood pretty much from the beginning, because the color is not desaturated enough not to realize it. And we see the blade. So it's all, the whole unfolding of the scene is all kind of, to the extent that it's supposed to be a punchline, that it's supposed to be building to that reveal, is kind of blown. Obviously, we know that it's a knife if you see this big knife blade sticking out from between her chest, from between her ribs. So it's, again, you've kind of given it all away. I don't know. And plus, there's this kind of weird guy dressed in a scream mask chasing her around with a knife, and I don't know what the hell that's all about. It doesn't make any sense.
Probably 2 seconds, and then that guy disappears from the rest.
And it's like, what's he doing there? Where's he come from? I don't know. Other than that, they just are ripping something off from Scream and sticking in this movie for no damn good reason. If it were another one of like the Hellraiser demons, it might make sense, but it's not. It's just like, who the fuck is that guy? What's he there for? No reason. Various problems that I have with Hellraiser Deader.
It sounds like it wasn't, it sounds like nobody got their way with that. Like, I read a little bit about it, and it just sounds like it's a bit of a mess. It sounds like it was done on the cheap, which is the exact reason that they filmed in Romania. It sounds like they were just told to put in a bunch of stuff of like, oh, make some J horror references because that's kind of hot right now, and like it just sounds like a just
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that people just kind of default to overhyping things. Sometimes you think, well, if this much is scary, then maybe we'll do this much, it'll be really scary. But doesn't always work. Sometimes a very simple thing is really all that you need. So it goes. what are you gonna do?
I think sometimes there is that kind of, particularly with stuff that is made by kind of bigger studios that is kind of more mainstream horror, there is this kind of tendency towards kind of overkill. And sometimes even in kind of haunted house movies that you can have jump scares, but you can have kind of jump scares that kind of creep up on you, whereas in the kind of I think like a lot of indie movies can, do well, and but there's a lot of the kind of more mainstream stuff, the bigger stuff, that's just like, well, you know what's really scary, like the jump is scary, but it's even scarier if we just make a big boom, sound effect right on top of it. And it's like, is it?
Well, you know what? I think the producers or even directors, they don't quite understand. I mean, they understand that reaction because it's so visible in an audience, that startle response, because you're trying to gain a response by looking at an audience, and that always produces that visible response. Everyone jumps, everyone screams, and well, obviously that works. Whereas the response to a kind of creeping reaction is often enormously more effective, but not as visible. No one is jumping out of their seats. No one is screaming. So you look at a movie like The Babadook or like Hereditary. They don't have a lot of jump scares, but the power of those movies to really be disturbing and unsettling, and to kind of stay with you. I mean, even something like the original Night of the Living Dead doesn't have an awful lot of jump scares, and yet the enormous growing sense of terror is just relentless. So
I'm not quite sure. I mean, maybe the artists, like, that's the kind of thing that they're focusing on. That's the thing that they're kind of mainly looking out for, that kind of visible kind of people jumping out their seats or whatever. But, like, so I remember when you mentioned Hereditary. I remember when I saw Hereditary in the cinema, I was, like, kind of, gripped to my chair. And, but you could feel the tension within the screening, in the audience, like you could feel it, so I don't understand necessarily how you could watch something like that with an audience or watch those quieter scares and not kind of sense that tension in the room, because like I feel it, and I've talked to other kind of horror fans, and they're kind of like, oh man, everybody was, and there's a deathly silence, and everybody's kind of like, oh, this is that you can, cut the tension with a knife kind of thing. I don't know.
I don't know either. It's just, I think that a lot of times the people who are making decisions about horror movies aren't necessarily the people who watch them or are fans of them. Mm. Not always the case.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I could remember what the movie was that I was having this discussion, I think, with an executive about some mainstream horror movie, and And it's just saying, it's like, you know, it's kind of a bore. There's just, there's nothing but jump scares. It's just one, it's like everyone, someone keeps turning a mirror and there's somebody there, and they turn a mirror and there's somebody there, and they open the door, somebody's there. And it's just jump scare after jump scare after jump scare after jump scare. And it's just boring. And she said, it's like, you'd be amazed how the power of the effectiveness of just jump scares. And it's like, would I? Yeah. Because I don't think that she, you know, she understood that, like, yeah, that there's a power of diminishing returns. Just shouting boo at people, that it does have a power of diminishing returns. And I'm trying to think, does The Shining even have any jump scares in it? I'm trying to think. I mean, I guess it does. Because when Wendy is looking at all work and no play, mm-hmm. Jack, but because we see Jack come up behind her, so we know that he's approaching when she jumps when he says, "Do you like it?" But we already know that he's there. So she jumps, but it's not a jump scare for us.
I feel like most of it comes from the kind of tension in the movie. Probably the jumps. I suppose when when he sees the woman in the bath and she turns into the old hag, that's kind of
I suppose. But you know, I'm not even sure that that would really qualify as a jump scare. Traditional sense of like, you know, of a startle moment.
I feel like it feels like the closest thing to it. There was the thing that I thought of that was the closest thing to it. Although, yes, I would agree that not necessarily.
Yeah. But you know, I just think it's horror being explored at so much more sophisticated level. I mean, I know Robert Wise's Haunting has basically one startle effect. When the wife pokes her head out through the trapdoor in the roof in the attic, but that's it. That's the one startle moment. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I think, like, as well, I think jump scares can be. It's interesting you say, like, you know, a lot of the producers maybe not being horror fans, because I think there is a sense of, like, kind of bigger, more mainstream kind of horror pictures of them kind of following a formula. And like you say, there's that kind of law of diminishing returns of, like, you know the formula of their jump scares. Like, so you know, it's kind of like watching a comedian where you know where the punchline is coming, so it doesn't work because you're like, so it's going to go quiet here, and then there's going to be, and maybe there's going to be a fake, like, cat jump scare, and then after the relief of the fake cat jump scare, and then there's going to be the real scare, and
but you see, the thing is, even sometimes, even when you know what the punchline is, you can still laugh, and that's why I'm sure you've seen really well-made horror movies many times, the same way you can see a well-made comedy many times, and obviously you know what the punchlines are going to be, and the damn things are still funny, or if they're not funny, they're not funny anymore. I mean, I've seen Airplane 10 to 20 times, it damn thing is still funny, and I
rewatched that during lockdown, and I've seen that movie. Yeah, I mean, a good 20, maybe 25. I still laugh my ass off. Yeah, sure.
So, the same thing with great horror movies. Even though you know where all the scares are coming, you know what the ending of Psycho is. It's still scary. It's like don't go down those damn stairs. Don't do it. Because the scare isn't in the surprise. The scare is in the structure. It's in the ratcheting. It's in the anticipation. You know, so your heart is beating.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. It's maybe less to do with the kind of knowing where it's coming. It's, and just more to do with I think a lot of the times they feel hollow is maybe the problem. There's no ratcheting of the tension, the suspense in the air that is missing, and all that is there is the jump scare. And when all that is there is a jump scare, it's not scary. It doesn't work.
It's just we don't identify with the situation. We don't identify with the characters. We don't care about them, and it's just like. It just becomes a kind of annoying assault on our senses. It's like ratchet, you know, like turning up the volume when the phone rings. It's like, oh, at a certain point, that just gets annoying. It's like, you know, it's like, will you turn the damn volume down on your phone? It's like, why, what are you trying to do? It's like, you know, it's like, and the answer is it's just a gimmick. It's just there solely for the purpose of making us jump, not to serve any meaningful dramatic moment within the structure of the story.
And I think that's it. I think it's all right to do jump scares, but as long as they're in the service of the story, of the narrative that you're trying to tell. And if they're just there to kind of bash you over the head with loud noises, then that gets tiresome very, very quickly. As we kind of come towards the end of the interview, as we've kind of gone into where we started talking about films you wrote, and then we just gone into the anatomy of the jump scare. As we come towards the end, I did want to briefly talk about, you mentioned as well that you did a lot of scripts for Full Moon Pictures, and I just wondered like how that relationship came about. I noticed from your IMDb credits that relationship started 25 years ago. It's still going strong today. You made movies just recently, last year, you know, a kind of Puppet Master spinoff that you wrote and stuff like that. So like, how did you first get into that gig, and how has that relationship lasted so long?
Well, I started, I was working for a company called Laurel Entertainment here in New York, working on a show called Monsters, and I was also their story editor on a bunch of various products and projects. And then they got absorbed and shut down. And I was, I had a wife and two kids, and I was looking for writing work, and there was not very much work to be had in New York. And I was familiar with Full Moon back from when it was Empire, and I knew their executive, Debbie Dion, at the time. And I wrote to her and said, you know, I'm interested in writing for you guys, and here's some of my credits, and would you be interested in hiring me? And I heard back from her and said, yeah, sure. We pay $3,000 for a feature. Would you? And I said, well, $3,000 for a feature, and since I got paid something like $4,000 for writing a half hour episode of Monsters, that doesn't seem like a lot of money. And then my unemployment insurance ran out, and suddenly it didn't seem like such a bad deal. So I started writing for them. One thing or another, I kind of kept on doing it. And again, I would, in between writing for them, I was writing stuff for myself, and ultimately started selling my own stuff. But in the meantime, I wrote just a ton of movies for Full Moon. I wrote horror movies and kid films and fantasy films and science fiction films, and just everything for Full Moon. I think I wrote, oh God, before I was done, I think I wrote close to 80, 90 scripts for them. I think just 40 or 50 of them ended up being produced in one form or another. So I've written a lot of stuff for Full Moon. And some of them were, I thought, came out pretty good. I mean, they're all very low budget things.
Yeah.
Some of them came out well, and some of them not so good. And some of them, you know, just as soon not talk about. But it depends, you know. So, you know, I think I wrote three or four of the Puppet Master movies, and a thing called Head of the Family and The Creeps and Hideous, which are all these weird kind of horror comedies. And they were just a kind of oddball trio of very weird offbeat horror films. And, you know, just good, bad, indifferent. You know, some of them are worth watching.
Is there any that you would particularly recommend to listeners? Any favorites of the many that you've written?
I mean, I think that those that weird trio of horror comedies is well worth watching.
So that's Head of the Family.
Head of the Family, Hideous, and The Creeps. I think two of them feature Jackie Lavelle, who is an exceptionally attractive young woman who's also just super funny, which is a rare combination. Anyone who's familiar with Charlie Band of Full Moon knows that he loves featuring attractive women who are prepared to take off their clothes, which, you know, Jackie Lovell's one of those women, but it's very hard to find women who'll take off their clothes who can also act, and Jackie Lavelle can do both. I wrote and directed a movie called Stitches, which I would like to recommend if you can find it. Let's see. You can date. I'm trying to think. Oh, anyway, you can always dig around. I've just done. There's a recent online thing called Trophy Heads, which is very odd. But you can want to give it a look, you can. I think there's another series of streaming things that I wrote, but they never quite finished it, so it's a little bit, yeah. It comes to a kind of indefinite conclusion. So this, you know, Charlie Band, like a lot of folks, is. It's an ongoing struggle to try to find money to make things.
Yeah, I suppose that's the struggle of indie filmmakers and indie film producers. Generally, yeah, for sure.
Okay. And I should mention that I've recently completed a book, a nonfiction book on horror screenwriting. It's going to be coming out in. The winter of 2022, called A Sense of Dread. Want to wait for, you'll have to wait for it, but it's going to be coming out. It's from Michael Weiss Productions.
Okay, well, I'll look out for that, and I'd be happy to read that, and I'll recommend it to any listeners when it comes out. So that's winter 2022. That's next year, right? Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And so apart from that, are you working on any screenplays right now?
I am about to, I'm starting on something. I'm going to be meeting with a director producer on Monday, but obviously it's a new project, so I can't really talk about it, but I'm always working on something. And, okay. And just finished up something for Charlie Band. So yet another Charlie Band project on the horizon.
Okay. Can you tell us anything about that one?
It's sort of a fantasy romance with boobs.
Okay. So classic Full Moon Pictures for all Full Moon Picture fans.
Classic Full Moon Pictures.
Okay, well, it's been great having you on the show, Neil, and you know, come back on again anytime, you know, like when the book's out, you know, I'd be happy to come back, you know, read that and have you back on at that stage. So thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure being here.
That was my guest Neil there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. I would also like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And please make sure you give us a 5-star review, because anything less than that means we are terrible, apparently, according to the algorithm. Weird, I know, but that's the world we live in. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!